Sarah Boggison, and tonight I'm going to be sharing part of what I experienced while I was in the Philippines. I was in the Philippines for a little under 3 weeks. First, I'll just start off by showing where I went. This is a small map of the entire Philippines. It's 7,100 islands, different islands. You probably can't see this very well, but we started off in Manila, and then we flew south down to Cagayan de Oro, which is down in the southern part called Mindanao. These islands in the southern part are Mindanao. This is a picture of Mindanao, larger. So from Cagayan, we went down. Some of the people went to Butuan and visited health workers and fisher folk and some farmers. I went with a group that came down to Malay Balay, and then we went up into the mountains. We hiked up in the mountains to a place where I was the second American ever to go up there. We're way up there, climbing up in the mud and visiting some farmers and some people who've been pushed off their land and forced to move up into the mountains because that's the only land that's left. Then we went farther south. We came down to Davao City. Now this, I'm sure you've heard a lot in the news about, if you've heard anything about the Philippines, it would be about Davao City, where it's a very violent city right now. For Trivial Pursuit members, you'd like to know this because it is the largest city in anywhere in the world, not by population, but by geographical size. Davao City, it's just this huge area here. They wanted to make it a city, and so they just roped off a huge area until they had enough to make it a city. Right now it's the political center, and there are, on the average, 3 to 5 killings a day by the government, and then there are counter killings by the NPA, or National People's Army. Over 100 police have been killed this past year by the MPA. So it's on both sides. It's a violent place. Then we came down here and went up to a place called Lake Cebu, which is a tribal people who have successfully been able to kind of organize themselves and survive. The whole Philippines used to be filled with tribal peoples. And they're slowly being pushed out of their lands or starving or whatever. But these people have been able to bond together, and it was really a neat place to see. To get up there, we had to drive in a jeepney, which some of you who've been in the third world know what a jeepney is. It's kind of like a truck taxi, I guess. That's how I explain it. People just pile in the back. They have two rows on the sides and the back, and it's open from about here down. But Americans are too tall for these. The Filipinos are small people. And so if you want to see out, you've got to hold your head like this. But a jeepney would normally hold probably 10 Americans. Well, we had between 40 and 50 people piled either inside or on the top, on the roof, hanging out the doors. As we chugged up to Lake Cebu and it got dark and it started raining, we had a flat tire. And at the point with the flat tire, I got out and counted people. And we'd already dropped off quite a few. And there were 43 at that point. So I know it was close to 50 at least when we started. But we did get up there, and then we got back down the next day. We came down to General Santos City and ended up flying from General Santos City up to, Cebu, and then back to Manila. We went a little farther north, and we went to Olongapo, which has a lot to do with Subic Naval Base, a U.S. naval base. It's actually the rest and relaxation area for our military men, otherwise known as a prostitution strip. Then we came back to Manila for a few days, most of us dead. We've been running around so fast. And had a few days to reflect on what we'd seen, and we had some speakers, some lawyers, some peasants come in and speak with us. The main idea of this tour was, first of all, to expose us to these different areas without giving us any preconceived ideas about what, if it's good or bad. And then we were to make our own decisions, and when we came back, we were given more background information regarding what went on. So with that, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on what the situation is in the Philippines, like their economic situation, their political situation. Marcos was elected, their president, Ferdinand Marcos, was elected in 1965. He was re-elected in 1969, and on September 21st, 1972, he extended his power to, he declared martial law so that he could extend his power, because in the Philippines up until that point, you could only serve a maximum of 8 years. Minimum of 4, maximum of 8. So after he had served 7.5, he declared martial law, and 20 years later, he is still in control. His family, at the time that he became president, they were not wealthy. They owned a few cows, which makes you wealthy, but now he has amassed a personal wealth of over $300 million. And maybe some of you saw last week, Imelda had come to New York to buy some property. That's part of what Filipino money goes for, is buying personal buildings for the Marcoses. One of our first nights in Malay Balay, we talked with a lawyer. He came in and he was just wonderful. He even typed up a speech for us to give it out. And I'd like to read part of what it was that he said. When we elected President Marcos in 1965 for a minimum of 4-year term or a maximum of 8 years, as our basic law provided to make this nation great again, little did anyone know that 20 years later, he would still be our ruler. USA has had 5 different presidents: Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Reagan. On the other end, Russia has changed leadership 4 times: Brezhnev to Andropov, then to Chernenko, and then Gorbachev. 20 years must be a long time, considering that 21,245,191 Filipinos, according to the data bank, have been born since then. At that time, 1965, foreign debt for our country was $599.5 million. Today, our loan should be no less than the government record for 1985 of $26 billion. While our population has grown only twice for the last 20 years, our foreign borrowings have swelled 4,300 times. No, it's 43 times. He made a mistake by putting 100 in there. Marcos overwhelmed the Filipinos in the presidential election of 1965. In order to win the 1965 presidential election, however, he solemnly pledged to do the following. Number one, to bring high prices and raise incomes. The main food of the Filipinos is rice. Rice in 1965 cost 0.88 centavos per kilo. It now costs 7.28 pesos per kilo. So that's an increase of probably tenfold. Okay, he also promised no more shortages or importation of rice. The Philippines still imports rice because multinationals have come in and taken over their rice lands, so now they import rice. And, well, I think you get the picture. He promised to reduce graft and corruption to a minimum. Number four, punish those who have enriched themselves in office. Number five, stop smuggling. Number six, faster land reform. And that's quite a joke, too. Jobs for the jobless, law and order, honest tax collection, rule of law, no persecution of political enemies. There have been over 70,000 who have been detained since he declared martial law in 72. And heroic leadership. So these are just some of the things. And also, the peso, in addition to things costing 10 times more, the peso has been devalued from, if you could buy 100 things for a peso before, you can buy 9 now. It's 0.09. What since 1965 to 1985. That's the devaluation. Okay, at present, the U.S. is still supporting Marcos, and we have supported him with military aid for the and economic aid ever since he's been in power. As Coleman McCarthy wrote in Seattle's paper last week, he said, U.S. support of Marcos is based on the narrow idea that a friendly tyrant is better than a communist tyrant. Last year, Reagan said that if we didn't back Marcos, it would be the communist wolves that would get us. This ignores the large number of Philippine political leaders who are offering a third alternative. It's called democracy. I will be explaining later on who the communists are in the Philippines and also who are the people who want democracy, this third option that this editorial is talking about. You might ask, why does the U.S. have such an interest in the Philippines? And there are many reasons, but as stated in U.S. World and U.S. News and World Report just last week, it says the stakes for the U.S. are high. Most important is the security of Clark Air Base and Subic Naval Base, the two biggest U.S. military installations outside of the U.S. Both represent U.S. strategic power, nuclear and non-nuclear, in the Western Pacific. They are a counterweight to the Soviet presence in Vietnam and essential to the peace of mind of American friends throughout a vast region. Subic Naval Base and Clark Air Force Base are up a little bit north and west of Manila, just to give you an idea where they are. Subic Naval Base covers 18,000 hectares, which is huge. And it's larger than all of our outside U.S. naval bases combined in all the other countries. If you add all those together and you put it in this one's still bigger. So a lot of land was taken from the Filipino people. But besides having a military interest, other U.S. interest is we've got a lot of multinationals over there. This is a map of Mindanao, and it just shows what the different multinationals that are involved, whether it be pineapple plantations, banana plantations. Firestone has a big rubber plantation over there. And it's not just the U.S. The Japanese, have controlled the fishing industry over the past couple of years. A lot of different things. I'll just leave this up here if anyone's interested. We visited, half of our group visited Dole. I think it was, the Dole Pineapple Plantation. And I went to the Del Monte Pineapple Plantation. Just before we went to the Del Monte Pineapple Plantation, we spoke with farmers who had been pushed off their land by Del Monte people. And I've got a story over here. I'm not going to go into it now, but I also have a contract that Del Monte handed out to the people. It's entirely in English and not even understandable by me. And English is my first language. It was forced in their faces and told them that it would offer them lots of good things. And if they wanted to refute it, they would go to a lawyer who was up in Manila, which most people in that area have never even traveled that far. You'd probably have to take a plane and none of them could afford it. And these people were forced to sign these leases, putting their land over to the plantation. And I could go on and on and on about different tactics they used to trick the people into taking their land away from them, such as plowing their land without asking them, putting in roads. And by plowing their land, they plow 2 feet deep, because that's what's good for pineapple. You don't need good soil for pineapple, you just need dry soil. So you make these furrows that are 2 feet deep, and the water stays down in the lower part, and you plant the pineapple up at the top, two rows on the top of the ridge. But if you've plowed a farmer's land like that, they've lost the topsoil. And it's non-recoverable. It takes years and years to get the topsoil again when you've brought it up 2 feet. So, yet when we visited the Del Monte plantation, I just felt more confused than ever, because the people who do work for Del Monte do get better wages than the rest of Filipinos. They do get medical benefits, which most Filipinos don't have. And they do have use of the 18-hole golf course. It's a hard situation, which I don't think there are any easy answers.
Sarah, mm-hmm. Who were the people working on the plantation before the plantation came?
Where were the people?
Yeah, were they the farmers?
They were the farmers. See, Dole and Del Monte come in there and say, you know, we're providing jobs for you. We'll take your land, but you can work for us. But it's been shown that only like 40% of them actually get jobs with Dole or Del Monte. And so they're off their land. They don't have anything. And most of them were paid for their land, or they're paid for their lease, for leasing their land. They pay it up front. They give them 5 years worth of lease money at one time. Well, these people don't know how to handle the money, and it runs out after 2 years. They have no land that they can even plant a garden on to make their own food. They're really out. So a couple weeks ago, when President Reagan sent his personal envoy, Senator Laxalt from Nevada, it was to protect our U.S. interests, which is the military and the multinationals. It was not for the good of the Filipino people. And I was reading a lot last week. In one article it said how Marcos would decide that he was going to combat. When Laxalt came over, he said, there are a lot of people that are unhappy, and we're worried about our investments. We want you to keep these people down. And in the past, the Marcos way of keeping the people down is by building up a huge military, and if people start talking, you either kill them or scare them, or some way of keeping them down. So when Laxalt came over this time, this was Marcos's answer. He said that he was going to pump in an additional $27.1 million to refit and deploy 5 new battalions after being debriefed on the Army's campaign against the rebels, the government said. So Marcos is planning on using the same tactic in dealing with the people. It's just more money into the military, it will mean more killings, things like that. Most of this money will go into what they call the Civil Home Defense Force. And the Civil Home Defense Force is people, Filipino people, who have been recruited into the Army. They don't have much of a choice, because if they decide not to come in, they're killed, or it's very dangerous for them. So these are men who are then each given a U.S. Armalite rifle, and they are told to stay within their community. They just go into each community, and they are supposed to keep the subversives under control within their community. It's highly militarized down in the south here in Mindanao. Each city we would go into, they'd have a barricade the beginning and end of each city. And there would be the army men sitting there with their guns, their rifles, checking out everybody who came into the town and who would leave. And if they felt that they didn't want someone to be in their town, they would take them out and rough them up. Some torture sometimes. Now, as Americans, we were very safe. When they would see a whole jeepney full of white people, they'd just wave us through. They would not stop us. Now, these men are not really trained. They are just given the guns, and they are told to keep the subversives under control. What does subversive mean? They've gotten some I guess I just get really frustrated. It's really painful for me to talk about this because I saw some people who had been killed, and I talked to a lot of people who have endured. Well, one woman, over 20 of her friends have been killed within the last couple of years. And they were considered subversives. I'm not sure you would consider them subversives, or I would, but they did. One of her friends was a union leader. He was trying to organize some union people. They stopped him, made him get out of his car, and he was shot in front of his wife and his youngest child. And this was her brother-in-law. Then, what the last night we were in the Philippines, she got a call, and a 19-year-old boy whom she had just seen the week before, a good friend of hers, he was a church youth leader, and a lot of church people are considered subversives, and he was taken away, tortured, and salvaged. They call it salvaging when they kill someone. Now, that's a real twist to the word, but when you talk about a salvaging, it means a government killing, and the paramilitary men go in and kill them. Yet, in a way, I kind of feel sorry for these men who are doing these killings because they don't want the job. They don't want to be forced into this position, yet they are made to be a part of the military and they have to do these things. Some of the torture tactics are, a lot of times they do the plastic bag treatment. And that's where they would put a bag over someone's head. And just until they're about suffocated, you know, then they pull it off and ask them to admit who the people were, confess who the other subversives in the community are. And if they don't admit anything, then they're killed. Usually they're killed even anyway, even if they've lied and said, this person are subversives, they're killed anyway. There's also the dirty water treatment, something I can't even fathom. If anyone's ever been in a public bathroom in the Philippines, it's just a little dish of water, kind of like very dirty water. And it's the same thing, shoving them, their face in there until they suffocate. Or confess. Physical abuse, kicking, hitting, stabbing, gunshots. The woman I keep referring to, her brother was attacked by paramilitary men. They think he's a communist. So they surrounded him, and he was down on the ground with his hands up like this, "I surrender." And they riddled bullets into him in his stomach. And luckily he lived. But he's still in prison unlawfully. I mean, there was nothing he did, but he is in prison. And the only reason he hasn't been tortured or killed in prison is that this woman's uncle is the head of all detained prisoners. So within their own family, they've got a government official who is in charge of all of this and family members who are being arrested and tortured or whatever, and being put in prison, kept in prison. Some of the typical subversives are the very poor farmers, teachers, fisher folk, nuns and priests, factory workers, and a prime target are peace and justice workers. And the main reason that they're considered subversive is they've started organizing themselves to survive, but their organization is outside of government organizations. So the government sees that as a threat to their power, that these people are really getting together. And most people have to form together in order to survive. Over 70% of the people do not have enough to eat each day. Over 70% are malnourished. They said only 3.5 families out of 100 actually do have enough to eat and medical. So it's everywhere we went, there was poverty. I'm sure there's poverty here in the United States, but it's just not as obvious Over there, it's everywhere. It can't be hidden. The roads go right through it. They don't go on the other side of town, but they go right through it. When we were over there, we asked people, that people would tell us their stories. And to me, I just feel so helpless. There's nothing I can do. So we asked them, what is it that we can do? And they told us, first of all, you can go back and talk to your government and try to end U.S. aid to Marcos. The second thing they said is, tell our stories to your friends back home. Let people know what's really going on. And so the rest of this, I'm just going to give a few stories of people that I got to know very well and would like to share with you. I told you that we came down to Malaiva Line, then went up into the mountains. And here we climbed up muddy mountains in the rain. And three of the men who took us up were men who had been falsely arrested in April. And they had just been freed from prison, detainee prison, a week before we got there. These men had been accused of murdering two other people. These two people had been murdered in their area, and there was a piece of paper attached to them saying the NPA did it, the National Public Army, which is, they say it's a group of about 12,500 people at present who are communist-backed, but who have fled to the hills to gain support and are sometimes take the law into their own hands. Now, I'm not sure those two people were killed by the NPA because there have been government people who've gone in and killed people and then put a sign on saying the NPA did it because it makes for a good story. And well, anyway, these three men, 12 were arrested originally. The rest were released except for these three men. They took us up to their homes. And one of the men told of, he was only my age. He had, I think it was 6 or 7 children. But while he was in prison, which was a day's journey away, a long ways away, there was no one to tend the crops, so they lost the whole crop. And his wife had to come and see him and bring him food because the detention centers do not provide enough food for the people. They are only allotted 8.5 pesos a day, which is about 40 cents a day for food. And oftentimes the guards take half of that for themselves because the guards aren't paid very much in the prisons either. So these men would die of starvation if they didn't have families to bring them food. Well, his wife came down to see him, and she stayed a couple of days. And when she got back, found out that their youngest had died of pneumonia because she had left him with the oldest child, I think, was 8, who was trying to take care of everyone. Yet the next day when we hiked down the other side of the mountain, and I was cursing because I was slipping and falling in the mud and couldn't maintain, this man was singing praise songs to God as he hiked down the hill. I couldn't believe it. And they were coming from his heart. They were real. I mean, if I had gone through all of that, I think I would be so bitter that I couldn't see any hope. Yet this man, he had joy in his heart.
Mm-hmm. Was he risking getting in trouble again by taking you in?
I don't think so. most of the military had moved out of their area after they had, first of all, accused these men and then taken them, and then they'd gone all the way to prison and then were finally released. And there's probably only 100 people who live up in these mountains, spread out in this territory, because the hills are so steep. As one person put it, you can farm both sides of an acre. They're so steep, but nothing lasts. It rained the whole time we were there, and most of the topsoil was being washed down at all the time. So the land cannot sustain a lot of people up there, so they're not that many there. I don't think, I mean, if being arrested once makes him more vulnerable for being arrested again.
It sounds like, Sarah, you found most of the people felt willing to talk quite openly.
Oh, yes. And
how do you come to that? Or didn't they feel that that would bring any repercussions?
Well, we were in safe places when they talked. We were not, when the lawyer talked with us and was saying all these things about Marcos, and he was very bold because he was at his own home, which had a big wall, or his sister's home, which had a big wall around it. The next day,
he gave a tight copy of the speech.
Mm-hmm. And he put his name on it, too. So he's also a leader of Bayan, which is, it means workers united. And so he's already kind of borderline anyway, but he really feels, and the people I met felt that it has gotten to the point where they can't be silent anymore. There are people dying every day anyway, and they have to fight for some, can't just sit back and watch other people die. So that's how they feel that they can go on. That's where their hope is.
Do we have any kind of elections at all?
Yeah, they did have one. I guess it was a couple years ago, and it was very funny. I mean, people were forced to vote for Marcos, or I can't even remember what election it was. In fact, these three men, the first reason that they got on the communist list or whatever is that they boycotted the election because they knew it was such a farce. And it's a rule that everyone must vote. But they said, we do not want to vote when we know our vote will be counted the opposite way anyway.
There was no opposition then for the voting. And there wasn't two parties.
Yeah, there are two parties, but when they vote, the count is, we even talked to some people who had to do the counting. These are school teachers, and they were told that they had to come in and change their results or they wouldn't get paid. And they hadn't been paid for the back 8 months of school teachers' pay. So they said they were forced to come in and change the results because they were starving. They didn't have any money left. And within a week, they got their back pay for the last 8 months.
Is the news media controlled by Marcos then, too?
Most of it.
Are the people, most of them literate?
Yeah.
Oh,
so. It is pretty good. But most can't afford a newspaper.
So this all, most of this passes by word of mouth? Like, they develop their political opinion?
Now, yeah, the Philippines is highly populated, densely populated. It's a lot different than here. You're never very far from another village. There's no place that you can just go out in the woods and be by yourself. There's always somebody within 50 feet or so, or not too far away. So I think talk spreads very fast. Okay, also when we were up in the mountains, we stayed at a family who was very poor, but they were so excited about their new co-op they had built. And this co-op was no bigger than the size of maybe two outhouses put together. It was really small. But they wanted us to take their picture in front of it and show it to our friends in the United States to show how they had formed something where they could store part of their grain so that they wouldn't have to sell it at the lowest cost. And it was also a place for storage so that they could feed everyone else in the community too. I mean, people eat the corn that we feed our animals here in the United States. But you should have seen the excitement. They had a meeting for us. Of all the people in the area, they came together to have their cooperative meeting and electing officers and discussing things, and women had a role just as big as the men in these cooperatives. One sideline, women bear the brunt of a lot of things in the Philippines. When we ate in that house, there was just one table, no furniture other than it, just that table. But it fit maybe eight people. So the men ate, and the three of us who went up there ate. Then the children ate, and if there was anything left, the women ate. there wasn't anything left. The women just don't eat. And if you look on the other side, the magazine right up there, there's an article about a woman who had, she needed medical treatment, but it either meant medical treatment or schooling for her children. So she decided to just slowly die of a kidney disease. Okay, I'm not sure if any of you heard about or read about it, but there was a peasant rally in Manila a week ago Monday. So it's almost 2 weeks ago now. And we were there for that rally. The night before, we had talked with several of the peasants who were going to be in the rally. They had come from all over Luzon, which is the middle Philippines area. Some had hiked probably 50 miles to come in. There were over 10,000 peasants who came in for this parade. And even a Nicaraguan peasant came up to join in the solidarity of it. He'd flown all the way up for this. Well, what they do in the Philippines when they have a parade, the peasants are not armed, but in front of them, they have a, what do they call it? Well, I can't think of the name of it anyway, but it's a group of people who will walk in front of the marchers, and a composite, I guess, that's what they call it. And these people are not armed, but they are people who are sympathetic to the causes that they are marching for and will protect them against any attack by the police. And like they will take the blows, they will take, you know, when they butt them with the, when they hit them with the butt end of a rifle and things like that. Well, here comes the parade. They've been marching from the U.S. Embassy, and they're marching down here, and they made a turn, and there's one street here. Okay, there's another road off here called Ayala Street. And the marchers were coming around here, and the composite was right ahead of them. Just after the composite got passed, none of these people were armed. I think they said it was five police cars came in. They started beating people with the butt end of the rifle. Then up above them, there's a streetcar, kind of like the L in Chicago. It came and it stopped right above them, and some paramilitary men jumped out and started shooting bullets at the people. The people laid down. That's what they did first. They were trying to do the Gandhian approach, laid down. Two of the people that were killed, one was a 17-year-old farming student. He was shot through the back of the head, and it came out of his eye. And then he was run over by the police vehicle, if that wasn't enough the first time. Several were injured, and they finally had to disperse. The peasants did retaliate after the gunshots came from above, and they started throwing rocks back. So that when it came out in the newspaper, I just had to, I got so angry. It says, Lazo was killed last Monday when police opened fire to quell a melee that erupted during a farmer's march during the 13th annual anniversary, which makes it sound like the peasants started it and that the government just had to go in there and settle things down.
Is that an American paper or a Post?
Yeah, this is Washington Post and United Press International sent this out. This is in Seattle thing, but that's where the article came from, UPI.
Sarah, you saw that?
I was not there myself, but there were people who did in our group. And that night, we went to the church where the peasants, see, the peasants had to split up then. I mean, they didn't all want to be killed. And they were going to meet back at this church. And we went to the church where they were providing food for them. And they had decided, after we got wrong information, they had decided that they would end the march at this point because people, even the peasants, were feeling violent and started up again on Friday. So a few peasants did come. I saw a couple people. One had a, you know, gunshot wound in the arm, and another woman, she was bleeding in her abdomen. And at that place, I got to talk with a lawyer. This lawyer works for the government. In fact, he was one of the top lawyers for Marcos. And he was always put on all these big national jobs. And Marcos came to him personally and said, you've got to quit going to marches. You've got to quit going to these displays of communism. And he said that he has to go. He just has to because of his, because he's a Filipino. He says, I have to do this. And so he was there, he saw the people being killed, and he was telling us about it. He's the one who told me that they backed over the man who had already been killed by the bullet.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, was there any time when you would have been like in Manila that you would have stayed in places where you would have had people who would have tried to, in quotes, give you the other side, or try to downplay what you saw was happening, or who would have been among those more well-to-do that profited by the present government? Mm-hmm. Do you have any contact at all with people like
that? On the airplane was probably the only place, because the wealthy segregate themselves from everybody else in the Philippines. We did, first of all, we went to the very wealthy in Manila. We saw the U.S. Embassy. It is guarded by several guards who stand around the front door of the house. And, you know, I'm talking about the ambassador's house, not the embassy itself, but the ambassador's house. And we saw, you know, went through the wealthy area. To get into the wealthy area, there are big gates with huge walls keeping everybody else out. So it is really hard to talk to them. But on the airplane, I did talk with one man who supports Marcos, and there was another woman who took some people out to dinner and took them to the fanciest place in Manila. And they had a very hard time stomaching the food because the night before we had been on Smoky Mountain, which is also in Manila, and it is an area where people have been pushed off their land, and the only place for them to go is the garbage dump. And Smoky Mountain is this garbage dump. And we walked through there. You know, they live on the garbage. They make their houses out of the garbage. As you walk along, it kind of gives. It's not like ground. And a lot of people live there. As we walked by a woman, I shouldn't say a woman, I don't know why I always think it is a woman, but there was someone in the house just retching. You could just hear her throwing up. And I thought, you know, I had felt kind of physically ill on this trip too. I got some intestinal problem. But when I'm feeling sick, I want to be someplace cozy and, you know, someplace where I'm halfway cared for. But knowing that whoever this person was that was so violently ill, that that person would never see a doctor, that person would never be able to get off this dirt they were living on. So it's such a contrast in within the city, within the country, the very rich and the very poor. There's really not much middle ground. I guess the only middle, you know, we did talk to Del Monte owners, some Filipinos who are high up in the Del Monte plantation, and they would talk like, well, these people are just lazy, they're not working, or there really isn't that much poverty. See how good we are for our people here.
And these are Filipinos talking about Filipinos.
Yeah. But these are Filipinos who have been wealthy now for 20 years or whatever, and they have been protected. They're in a little oasis. The Del Monte Plantation is an oasis with its 18-hole golf course and its club, and people live, every house is about the same, and it's kind of like an army base or an Air Force base where everybody's got their allotted little spot.
The Del Monte workers live on the...
They live right there. They're picked up in trucks from their houses. And, you know, you just stand in the back of the truck. They take you out, you work for your 10 hours or whatever, you get back in the truck and they drop you right off at your house. You never leave your little oasis plantation. So, one last place I want to talk about is Olongapo, which is the recreation area for our naval men. And we went there, it happened to be the time of the typhoon. So we didn't get to go on base, because when there's a typhoon, the ships are safer when they're out to sea rather than being in at shore and maybe banging up against each other. So we didn't actually get to go on the base. But we were there two nights, and the second night some of the men got to come back in from being out at sea. And we got to just walk up and down the strip watching men pick up women. It's a little bit more refined than you would think of a streetwalker. They have what they call bar finds. The women work in the bar and the man must come up and pay her bar fine, which is, I don't know how. I mean, first of all, he pays a certain amount just to talk to her, you know, to buy a drink and sit with her. And then if he wants her for 24 hours, then he pays her bar fine and she's his for 24 hours. And what was amazing to me is how embarrassed these American servicemen were when they would see American women walk down and they'd have, I saw several men that had two, one on each arm. But as soon as they'd see an American, you know, there were a bunch of us, they'd pretend like they weren't with them and kind of brush off the woman and kind of maybe start to walk across the street or something like that. And of course these women just followed them because that's what they're paid to do. And then we talked with three of the, they call them hospitality girls. I prefer to call them hospitality women. And I'll just tell the story of one of them. I mean, they talked for 3 hours. I was really surprised. I thought that they would feel intimidated or would not want to talk to us. Here we were, a bunch of Canadians and Americans, sitting there, staring at them, and yet these three women came in and told their stories, and very open and honest. And I was humbled, because I had a lot of preconceived ideas of what kind of person is a hospitality woman. One of the girl, she looked like she's probably only maximum 18 years old, and she'd been in the Olongapo 14 years. I mean, 4 years. She was 14 years old when she was taken from her home. Her father is a poor farmer who wasn't making enough money for their family. So when the recruiter came around to her community talking about how she could get a job as a cashier at a grocery store or at a bar, she was really excited. And so she came to Olongapo. When she found out there weren't any jobs like that, she took a job as washing clothes. Couldn't make enough money at it. Then she tried to get back home, but she didn't have enough money to get back home. And I mean, the story goes on and on and on, how she was tricked through all of this. And she ended up working as a hospitality woman. And another one of the women, Sue, she had a baby by an American serviceman, and he promised to marry her and all this stuff, and she waited and waited, and he never came back. And that's common. A lot of times they'll even get married, and then he'll go off for his next 6 month leave and not come back. And the U.S. does not allow the wife even to find out the whereabouts. But this Sue, she had her baby, and she gave her baby to her mother. And she says, the only reason I'm a hospitality woman, she says, I don't like it, but she says, I have to send my money home to support my baby. And she kept saying, I love my baby, I love my baby, and would cry. And it just made me feel like, who am I to sit here and make her feel like she's gotta convince me that she loves that baby? She dearly loved that baby, and that's why she was doing it. And I think the thing that amazed me of all the women we talked to is that she, is that they loved so much, even though they'd been deceived, abused. They come back and all they still love. They love so much, and that's shown through the most.
The
95% of the people are Roman Catholic, and that's another thing about these women. They're very devoted. They believe in marriage and devotion to that one person. So when they are forced into a situation like the prostitution, it is so opposite of what they're used to. And also the church shuns them. They can't. Many of these girls go there and then can't go back home because their family won't accept them, or their community won't accept them, their church won't accept them.
And how does the church fit into the political scheme?
I've got some information here, church and the Philippines. The church in the past has played kind of like, let's keep the status quo. Let's not make many waves. And recently, the U.S. Embassy has been checking up on what American churches are doing. You know, like there's an American pastor at the place that we stayed in Ilongapo, and they're checking up on them, kind of monitoring them, which doesn't leave much for a division between church and state.
The U.S. Embassy is doing that? Not for the church's protection.
No. But there's a picture in here of some of the prostitutes, and I'll have to pass around 24 or 25, but beautiful women, young, very young, most of them age like 14 to 25, around there. But yet you can tell from this picture when I pass it around that they're nervous. They're kind of agitated, like these women that talked to us, they'd laugh, but you knew it was close to tears. That kind of nervous laughter. Because they're forced to be loud and jolly, like a bar, you know, because they're working in bars and you have to be above the music. When a Filipino person, it's part of their culture that they're very quiet. It's very disrespectful if you yell across the street to someone and say, "Hey, you." They do things like they go, tss, tss. That's how they get someone's attention. And it's subtle, but yet everybody notices it. Or they do everything indirectly. So it takes them out of their culture in the first place and puts them in a situation where they don't feel at ease. I just want to quick say what I think part of the hope is. I got to the point about three-fourths way through that I decided there was no hope. And I just broke down and I said, you know, where is God? Is God just sitting here watching this and laughing? You know, I felt no hope. But then I started looking around at the people. And they've gone through this. They've experienced these things, yet they have a sense of calm, a sense of a real spirit, a real faith that grew out of their persecution. You know, like the prostitutes, even through all their deception, they still loved. When I looked at children were just so wonderful over there. They never fought, they were bickered, they're very quiet. They don't have anything to fight over. They have one pair of clothing and nothing. No other things to fight over. And they have to take care of each other because the mother can't take care of 13 children or 10 or how many children she has. I saw hope in that the lawyers are on the side of the people and not on the side of the government. That's unusual. I think in our country I always consider lawyers to be pretty conservative. But in the Philippines, lawyers are very liberal and they're kind of high on the salvage listing. A lot of lawyers have been salvaged. And I think I got hope from my friend Jet, the one I talked about who'd lost her, or her brother had been shot, who had lost her brother-in-law, who was good friends with Carl Gaspar, if anybody's read the book, How Long, a man who had been political prisoner and was finally released after 2 years. And he's coming over to the United States pretty soon, I think. But I saw hope in how she seems to find energy to keep moving. You know, I asked her, how do you go through the mourning process? And she said, you know, I wouldn't know where to start. I wouldn't know which one to mourn for, because there's been too many. But she said, so I just have to remember that I'm working for something that is bigger than myself. And I'm not the only one in this. And so that's where she sees hope. I don't know, and this has been real disjointed, this session I've given here. I don't think I've tied it together very well. But part of that is because we did see so many things, I experienced so much, and I'm still processing that. I've got lots of information around here, if anybody wants to look at it. And I just want to say that there are things that we can do. We heard it everywhere, that please stop the U.S. Marcos dictatorship. It's not just Marcos dictatorship, it's the U.S.-backed Marcos dictatorship. Encourage, write letters, whatever it is that we can, to stop military aid to Marcos. And I would even go so far as to ask to just get the military bases out of there. Abandon that. But another thing could be keep informed of what's going on. And I know of a lot of different organizations in the Philippines who really could use monetary help. And these are done through Mennonite Central Committee knows a lot of these, and they bring the money right to the people, as Mennonite Central Committee acts as the agent. Another thing that we could do is ask our government to only give aid to private organizations rather than giving it to the government. Because we give it to the government saying, we give it with good intentions sometimes when we say we want this for economic aid, but it ends up going just to Marcos and the government. Canada has, their government has decided that they will not give any aid to the Marcos government, and all their aid is funneled through private organizations.
So this, Sarah, is it easy for private organizations to function like that then?
They become under attack. They become known as subversive organizations, but there are means to get to them, like through Mennonite Central Committee and through other things. But they can function. And I've got a lot of things right here, like this is Task Force Detainees of the Philippines. And these are people who investigate missing people, you know, the ones that have been taken by the government. They are a really good organization, and they invite people to come over and be picture takers or to document what's really going on. And a lot of times if they have an American or Canadian or some white person over there helping with their organization, they're a lot safer because they know that the government would not attack an American.
Did you or any of your group get to take pictures?
Mm-hmm. In some areas, we could not take any pictures of military or of the U.S. military areas, but we could take pictures almost anywhere. People were very open to having their picture taken. In fact, children just loved it.
What about some of the abuse pictures that you described?
I didn't take any pictures of it, but I saw many. Because we worked with some of these task force detaining people, and one of the nuns who was in task force, she brought over pictures of the latest latest killings, and for us to see. You see, you have to really document these, and still the government doesn't give you a trial, even after documenting them. I guess my greatest point of despair on the trip, or when it really sunk in, was when we were at Task Force Detainees, and I asked the question, and it was a naive question. I said, what happens to the people, to the military men who have killed someone else? You know, who've killed somebody. What happens on trial? And he looked at me and he said, they're promoted. The military men are promoted for each person they kill, each quote subversive. And there's no trial or anything like that. And so that's when it really sunk into me how corrupt this system is. And I mean, it's blatant, it's right there.
Sarah, did you get to talk to anyone at the embassy, any official at the U.S. embassy?
Now, I did not go to the embassy, but there were 8 Americans who did. And it was the day after, it was just a week ago Tuesday. And they were very diplomatic about everything. They said...
They mean the ambassadors?
We didn't speak... Holmes, what is his name? I don't know his first name. Something Holmes.
Richard.
Yeah. That's who they spoke with. And he was nice enough to answer their questions, and he gave them an hour and a half of his time. And he basically said, yes, there's a lot of bad things going on in this country, but we think the military can control it.
Did they get the feeling, and did anyone report the feeling that he was just towing an official line and not really feeling that himself?
Since I wasn't there, I don't know. But they came away with a more positive attitude than they thought, because he knew about things that were going on. He had actually traveled to some of these places in the southern Philippines, and they were afraid. A lot of times in embassies, you've got someone who's just sat behind the walls of the embassy and haven't gotten out and seen the people. But he did admit, too, regarding this peasant rally, that it was the government who attacked, and that these peasants had nothing to do with it. He admitted that, but yet still, the United Press, the international that was released, and that goes through our embassy, he gets connected with that, they read it,